Hello and welcome to another episode of the GDL podcast. It's me, your boy Ahmed, and today we're going to be talking about the latest Switch model, the state of play with from PlayStation, and kind of like some of the latest goings on with regards to like the dev side of things. But with me today, a man who needs no introduction, Mr. Chris Payne.
Hello, happy to be here.
good to have you again, man. It's always a pleasure to chat with you.
So, are we doing Switch first or PlayStation?
Yeah. Let's go Switch. It's the freshest piece of news. It kind of also came out of absolutely nowhere.
It did. That was a surprise.
Yeah. So, like, if you've not heard, like, the Nintendo have announced the Switch OLED model. That is literally the name that they're marketing it with, which is like interesting at first, considering that usually like they would have some sort of like prefix or suffix, like the game, like for example the Game Boy Advance, same system, just kind of different mode, like between like the normal Advance and the Game Boy Advance SP, because it had like that's two halves sort of thing, and even with other DS consoles. So it's interesting to see them just kind of just call it what it is, literally just like it's Switch OLED because it's got OLED screen.
It's crystal clear, and I think they're probably banking on OLED still being a kind of new and sexy technology.
Yeah, that's definitely, because like I mean, it's hard to call it a new and sexy technology when it's kind of just standard in most phones nowadays. It's just like
on phones, yeah,
yeah. And like just like it's just super popular with like mobile technology, and it's, I mean, like it's especially like fancy when it comes to like TVs and stuff, because you still get a lot of TVs that like don't, like OLED is like the premium that you pay for with TVs. But yeah, it's interesting that they've kind of like it's interesting that they've gone down that route to kind of like what you call it, like get up to speed with like other mobile technologies.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that they're competing with mobile phones particularly, because that they have a quite a unique form factor. So it's definitely, Switch is definitely better for playing games on than a phone, by virtue of having proper controllers.
I do personally agree with you. I feel like there would be some people who would disagree, because like the mobile market is kind of, I don't know, it, like there are a lot of people who've like started like who play games on mobile phones that don't really fancy the appeal in more traditional like console games that you would on a Nintendo console.
I guess so. I mean, it depends. The difficulty with mobile, I think, is although, obviously, mobile gaming is a solid 50% of the games market at the moment, but it's a very different market. It's a very different experience. So where the PC and console market is people who will invest in a dedicated piece of hardware specifically for playing games, or a high-end PC that is good for playing games, and they're into games for the sake of games. They enjoy that particular experience, and they want they're looking for new game experiences. So that half of the market is an audience that is hungry for content, and has invested into equipment for, you know, because it's their hobby. Whereas the mobile market, although it's vastly bigger numerically, most of those people are just trying to kill time at the bus stop, or they're just sort of like they're a little bit bored with what's on TV, and so they're playing Candy Crush or something. Those players, which are sometimes dismissed as casual players, they are less invested in like a high quality games experience. They just want to be entertained for 5 minutes, and so on, and they're willing to sort of like spend small amounts of money to be entertained for 5 minutes and sort of like buy some like lollipops or Candy Crush and you know, and do that sort of thing, which is why microtransactions work, because like that sector of the market is not interested in shelling out 350 quid on a piece of hardware specifically for playing games on. So, but I'd say I think the Switch OLED is going to be a great entry point for people who hadn't got a Switch yet.
I think its
value as an upgrade is a bit more questionable, I think.
I agree. I mean, a general outline of the new features is that the screens, the OLED screen, it's a little bit bigger. Mm-hmm. Like, they've improved the sound quality a bit. The dock has improved. Like, it's got a fixed LAN connection, so you can, like, it's something that definitely caters more towards, like, the fixed, like, seated, actually, like, sitting down and playing a game sort of thing. Because having that fixed internet connection is a lot better than just having to rely on Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
Especially with games like Splatoon, where, like, you're always online and you need that stable connection, or even Monster Hunter, like the latest one, you need that stable connection. And so I feel like in certain situations that just have it, the fact that it has a LAN connection, if it wasn't for the fact that it's $350, so they've not announced the UK price. No, it's fine. But like they've not, because they've not announced the UK price, it's still, it'll be like around that, like $300 to $325. If they go full $350, that'd be interesting. But it does cater more towards both to those who choose to play the Switch handheld, but also like the improvements to the dock, if you prefer it docked. Which is interesting, because like the previous Switch iteration, they literally just called it the Switch Lite. And it is very much just a handheld console. Like there is no dock.
Yeah.
There's no dock involved. It's just you can't even swap out the Joy-Cons.
Yeah, well that's an interesting one actually with the Switch Lite, because it means that it limits the amount of two player stuff that you can do. But I think that there is an implicit assumption that it is cut down, and it's great if you just, that's one of the cuts they've had to make to get the price down. And I think that, you know, because if people wanted to play it multiplayer with their friends, sort of like the standard Switch does that for them. Yeah. So what they were trying to do with the Switch Lite was sort of like capture the part of the market who are basically solo players or online only players, and didn't they wanted a cheaper option. And I think that the Lite is pretty good for that if you like handheld gaming.
Absolutely.
So if all your friends have got Switches and you were feeling left out and you couldn't afford the standard Switch, then I think the Lite is a great option, because you can take it, you can meet up with your friends somewhere, or at least you could if it wasn't a pandemic. You know, you can play, but you know, Bluetooth works over 2 meters, so that's
true. Fine. Exactly, so you can be socially distanced. You can have telescopic vision as well if you're going to share the same screen.
Oh God, yeah. Well, this is the thing, is that if you wanted to join in with your friends and you've got your own screen and your own controllers, rather than trying to sort of like play on your mate's like detached controller, having your own screen is good, and being able to practice at home and stuff like that, it's a different experience. But I think Nintendo have done really well to capture that sort of kind of like portable handheld gaming market. I've never really been into handheld gaming very much, because I don't find that it's a very good experience looking down at something in my hand. It makes my neck ache. I can't play games on my phone for long periods. And it's a small screen, and because I am I'm a gamer and I've invested in consoles on the big screen. I want to see games on my big screen. But there are people who only play games socially with their friends. And so they want to be able to do that down the pub or while they're traveling or stuff like that. And I did find that I started using my Switch on the train while I was traveling, and it was great. Really good. Yeah. And a lot easier than sort of like trying to get a, you know, get out a laptop on the train. So
no, I definitely agree. I've actually started to see like people actually playing their Switches on trains now. Not like just not recently,
no.
Like cause the coronavirus, but generally like it's not an, it's an uncommon but not a rare occurrence. Like I sometimes I wouldn't be surprised to see people that, if they have their Switch out and like they're playing on the train. But I mean, it's funny you say that because like for most of my life, even though I've always had like a home console, I've also always had like a handheld, like just. Kind of to play portably in like situations. So like for example, if my mum's watching the soap opera sort of thing, I couldn't go down and play on the GameCube, so I played on the Game Boy Advance. And so that's kind of like sat with me, but I've never felt an affinity to mobile gaming, funny enough. I've always been like handheld consoles are my experience, and I didn't see the appeal in like mobile games because, like you said, people most of their player base aren't people who are like getting a phone to play games. They're getting a phone to like call, browse the internet, and like all that jazz and communicate fundamentally.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Actually, one last interesting thing about the Switch OLED is the design of it. I actually really like the slightly sort of like off-white color and presentation. It looks a bit more sophisticated, and I think that ties in with the whole sort of like marketing it as an OLED thing. It's for people who want sort of like a high quality experience and willing to pay for it. So it's presented as a kind of like sophisticated, high quality thing rather than the brightly colored sort of like this is for kids presentation.
I'll tell you what I feel like they've tried to imitate. I feel like it's tried to imitate the PS5, like the white on the black.
I mean, you could argue that the PS5 is just imitating the Xbox 360 where they went right. Yeah. You know, these are design trends that kind of like ripple through. I mean, fundamentally, I think generally it is, if you change something, even something kind of small, like the color of the controller, it feels fresh and it sets it apart. And it feels like, oh, I have a new and slightly improved thing, even if it's, you know, a purely cosmetic change, but it's psychology, isn't it? It's making people feel like they've got the new thing.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. But, it's standard for PlayStation, not PlayStation, Nintendo. Wow.
Well, speaking of PlayStation,
yes, like the recent state of play that they announced, a lot of like. I don't. So this is the thing. I'm not sure if they're entirely new games or had that just or so basically either games that I've just missed from my radar, or have been like completely new announcements. There are a few announcements and a few obvious returning titles, like the updated Death Stranding, and a few others.
It's interesting. I mean, it's nice to see more Moss, because that was gorgeous, gorgeous game. There's a bunch of interesting sort of like new stuff that I've been vaguely aware of, but is finally here. So like there's the Jet, I don't know how to pronounce it, the Jet, the Far Shore.
Yes.
Looks looks interesting. And then yeah, as well as and obviously like Deathloop is quite exciting. Yeah. I'm a big fan of Arcane, so that's one on my list.
Yeah, I'll talk about Jet in a minute, but like Deathloop, when I first saw it, because I enjoy Arcane games. I loved like the first Dishonored. I got on with the second one, but didn't like I played it at a friend's house, so I didn't get to enjoy it fully. I played through Prey, but I'm also like a massive, massive wuss. So when it comes to like jump scares, I will genuinely jump and genuinely be scared. I got far in it, but I don't think I was able to complete it because it just got a bit too much. I was so tense. I was like grinding my teeth and I was like, I need to stop. I need to put this down and pick up another time. And I've just not got around, like back around to it. But I got decently far, I think. I do see like the Arcane kind of combat, like especially with like the blinking and like the stealth, because like all their games are kind of stealth focused to mm-hmm. some degree. But yeah, like the whole like 3D FPS roguelike like that they're going for, and with that latest trailer, I find it more compelling, and I'm actually quite invested. I do want to play it.
I really like the proposition with Deathloop that it's basically, it's kind of an open world, and you can basically poke at like all these different. It's basically a whole bunch of different puzzles to solve that, and then trying to figure out a way of then. So you can get the satisfaction of solving one particular puzzle and figuring out a way to take down one of the baddies, but then you've got to try to figure out a way to do the full set of baddies in a single run somehow.
Yeah.
And that will probably require you to sort of like grind a bit and acquire sort of like improved gear so that you can get around the island faster and so on. But I think it's a great concept that means that you can basically go and you can immediately explore and play, but solve puzzles and feel like you're making progress. But to 100% the game, you have it's more of a puzzle to solve rather than just sort of like a linear sort of like grind further and further through more and more content. I think that's very clever, actually, in the sense that the amount of content in that game, I would think, is probably a bit less than most AAA titles.
Yeah.
But very, very highly polished and very carefully balanced, so that there's going to be some of those bad guys that are going to be easier to take, quite easy to take down. And therefore sort of like they will be easily incorporated into a run where you can take down multiple baddies. And then there's going to be some that are incredibly sort of like tough or time consuming, or the timing has to be very, very specific. And you have to maybe interleave that with, you have to do some setup to set things in motion, then go and tackle another boss and then come back and so on. I can imagine it being an absolute nightmare to try to solve.
Thing that it does remind me of, like the whole how you have to get trying to get through like the loop in one go, it reminds me of Majora's Mask, where kind of spoilers, but the game is older than most people. But it's basically like at the end of the game, to complete the game, you still have to beat every boss all over again because you reset time, and so once you're trying to do your final run, you have to you basically get shortcuts to the bosses, and like just like smash through each of them and get to the end boss in time, otherwise, like, it's game over. So yeah, I'm interested to see how like how they bridge like the shortcuts so you're able to get through it, especially considering that you can get a drop in enemy assassin who's like, it's a similar situation but not, and it's just like your flip side, and they're gonna like, they're out there trying to kill you to stop you from like fixing the loop.
I'm fascinated in it from a game design perspective. It sounds like almost sort of like an entirely new genre, because of all of the elements have been done before, but the way that they've put them together feels very fresh. And obviously the style is really sweet.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that whole sort of 60s, 70s kind of
aesthetic.
Yeah.
You don't really see it often. But no. It's nice. It's nice.
Yeah.
But yeah, but like alongside that, like you mentioned Jet, which gave me like old school Star Fox vibes, like the whole like it was basically from what I saw of it, it looked like you're kind of running through a route, you were kind of fixed close to the ground but not on it, so like you were like hovering over it and like dodging obstacles. So I'm not entirely sure if that is what Jet is, and I just like saw something different in the trailer, but I did get like Star Fox vibes, like watching like the ship gameplay sort of thing.
I haven't played a lot of games of that ilk, but I do like arcadey dogfighting is so fun. It looks really interesting.
Especially with the narrative twist that they've given it, because it seems quite serious, because they're like, the way they're talking about it, it doesn't seem like a lighthearted experience. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, that looks cool. I'm just having a quick look at some of the other stuff that's in there. So there's things like Hunter's Arena Legends, which has got some an interesting sort of like Baroque art style. Looks like it's a
it looks like a bit of a MOBA, like it gave me vibe. Like, I don't know if you've played it, but Smite.
I haven't played Smite, no.
But it's kind of like a 3D MOBA sort of thing, and it feels a more adventure RPG version of that. I mean, I don't know how fixed like the maps are like compared to your normal MOBA, but it does give me that kind of feeling.
It's interesting. I can't really comment on that because like MOBA is a genre that has passed me by, because I don't really play online. I have very little time so playing multiplayer games is just sort of like hiding to nowhere if I'm actually competing with other real people who have got much more time to practice than I have. So it's barely worth it. The other thing that caught my eye was Fist, Forged in Shadow Torch, which apparently is about mutant animals in mech suits.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's like mutant animals is like in like mutant animals and like dystopias is coming back. Like, at first it was what's that camera game? Oh my god, I can't believe, one of my favorite games. Like, it came out years ago.
Beyond Good and Evil.
Yeah, Beyond Good and Evil, where it had a future animal like sort of thing.
Yeah.
And recently there was
Mutant Year Zero.
Yeah, Mutant Year Zero, I think it was called. And now there's this, so it's an interesting take. You rarely see it, so yeah.
It's a very distinctive look, it'd be interesting to see how they distinguish themselves from the other entries in that very distinctive sort of visual genre. But as I say, I'm really excited for more Moss, because that's beautiful. And then there's some other like interesting entries, like Arcadegeddon.
Yeah,
that's a weird one. It kind of looks sort of Overwatchy.
Yeah, kind of Overwatchy, kind of like Splatoon with the colors. I'm interested to see how it works, because yeah, I'm not sure what it, I'm not sure what to expect from it.
That one's out on early access, or if you actually have a PS5. So
well,
yeah,
I know what I'm doing today.
Sadly, I don't.
Oh, mate.
This is a difficult one, actually, because it's very hard to get excited about anything coming on PS5 when I can't actually get hold of the console to play it on.
You know what? That's obviously absolutely fair. It's kind of wild that we're still having issues.
It is quite astonishing that a year on, it is still impossible for even like people who work in the industry to get, who, you know, people, I know people who have got kind of like desktop alerts to like stock becoming available in stores, and they still can't get hold of one. I'm just kind of like, well, fine, I will wait until they do become available. But, you know, if people that I know who have got alarms set up are still going to find it, it makes me wonder how viable it is as a platform for selling games on, frankly, because how do you, I don't know what the numbers are. I don't know how many they shifted so far. I presume that they're basically selling everything that they make, but it just seems a bit odd that the supply and demand is so off kilter for this particular console.
I mean, like, the only other time I feel like I've seen it that bad is usually with a Nintendo release, because they always vanish. Like, I remember the
switches were very hard to get hold of for a while.
And I mean, like, even on the Switch itself, like with Ring Fit, it took me 4 months of hunting, or more than that, I think, of trying to get that game, because it had like, it has like very unique specific hardware for it.
Absolutely.
But but I feel like the PS5's kind of taken the mick a bit. Like, it's
just, I mean, a thing. In fairness, the Xbox Series X is also hard to come by, but doesn't seem to be quite as tough as the PS5. But we'll see. I think that the main problem, though, is that although I'm interested in upgrading to new consoles and everything will be shiny and so on, we're not seeing anything that is really pushing the envelope. Particularly, we're seeing some games that are just like AAA games where they've just not bothered to do a current gen version, but the gameplay doesn't seem to be any significantly different from a PS4 game. And I think that this is the problem, is that with each console generation now, we're seeing like diminishing returns, because everything looked pretty damn good on a PS4 or an Xbox One already. So it can look a little bit better on the next gen consoles, but that doesn't necessarily translate into being able to do anything new in gameplay terms. I think that we have already basically got almost total freedom to build any sort of game that we want on the current generation hardware. The challenge now is making it more accessible, because the difficulty now is that it's very costly to make games that look good on PS4 and Xbox One. This is why we've seen a lot of studios retreating from photorealism and going for various different stylized looks. So Ubisoft, for example, released Phoenix Rising. Sorry, it used to be called Gods and Monsters. Phoenix Rising is there. It's basically, you could argue, it's like Assassin's Creed for younger audiences. It's got it's got a really nice cartoony style. It's got all of the open world exploration gameplay that you'd expect from an Assassin's Creed. It's also got dungeons that are very reminiscent of Breath of the Wild.
I do remember. I kind of do want to play it, just because I've started to feel like I've a preference for this kind of stylized,
yeah,
like,
yeah, It's really fun. It's really pretty. It's really fun to play. In some respects, I think it's even... Obviously, it borrows quite a lot from Breath of the Wild, but in some respects, it's even better than Breath of the Wild because it's much more sort of densely packed. There's a lot less open, empty space than Breath of the Wild has. There's... a lot of games that are going for this more cartoony style because, frankly, it's an easier bar to hit and excel at. If you're going to go for photorealism like Death Stranding or The Last of Us 2, that is a real challenge. One of the things that I thought was funny, actually, was all of the excitement that I saw on Twitter when people were sharing clips of a cutscene from The Last of Us 2 in which a character puts a jumper on. Because never mind your sort of a big flashy movie special effects. In video games, it is the really simple stuff that is the hardest, getting human beings to interact with each other, with the environment, with objects. It's really bloody hard to do that without them clipping into things or stuff like that. So for characters to get dressed is a phenomenally complicated thing to make a skinned skinned model with a skeleton interact with a simulated piece of cloth. I don't even know how I would begin to tackle that.
I mean, like in that same game, they made they had a completely interactable cable lead that you because there was a puzzle. There's a simple puzzle, but the fact that you had this fully interactable cable of a fixed length. And it bent and moved like a cable. It blew my mind. It's just
they did something similar in Uncharted 4 with the winch from the front of the Jeep that you could use to sort of like loop around a tree and get the Jeep up a steep slope. That I remember seeing that and going sort of like, oh my god, look how detailed this is, and the fact you can hook it onto itself and it pulls taut and so on. It's like this is the level of AAA development. That particular winch that was used, I think, 3-4 times in the entire game.
Yeah.
That will have been weeks and weeks of work by a gameplay programmer making damn sure that the collision of that steel cable and the hook and the tree that you loop it round all worked perfectly and so on. And they will have been testing corner cases for that and what happens if you hook it on and then you try to drive the Jeep off a cliff. And it will have been a phenomenal amount of work to make that look trivial and real. It behaves just as you would expect it to in real life, and that's incredibly hard to achieve.
Absolutely. I the fact that it took the steps to make it feel like it was normal is huge. So kudos to them.
Even down to little details, you're holding on to this rope, and if you just sort of turn around on the spot, then Nathan passes the cable behind his back, and across from hand to hand, either behind his back or in front of him, depending which way you're turning, so that you can never get it tangled around you. He passes it around. Yeah. And it's the animators must have sworn at having to create all these I wonder the amount of planning. I mean, I wonder if they motion capped that. Would they have known that was going to be a problem down the line and done motion capture for it? It could be that would be a second sort of motion capture shoot just to do pickups for specific movements.
Well, so you know what? I think it probably was a problem that they found in the development of Uncharted 3 and only got round to actually dealing with it in 4 because they knew it was going to...
That's a very good point. And that's one of the benefits of big budget franchises iterating on basically sort of effectively sort of remaking the same game with knobs on, yeah. and making it bigger and better and doing all of the things that they probably thought about doing back in Uncharted 1 and then went sort of like, no, that's too complicated. The tech's not there. And so on. So getting back to the original topic, that is the sort of thing that it is that level of detail and incredible sort of like simulation fidelity is something that only AAA studios can afford to do, because like I say, an indie team cannot afford to have like a senior programmer spending like weeks and weeks making a flipping cable winch work. Unless the entire game is about cable winching.
You only need to look at the credits to see like they would have probably had like one person dedicated like 2-3 years of their life to that, to cable winches. But yeah, I mean like that's the thing, because like as an indie dev, like there's only so much you can do, like your budget's already tight. Just trying to put food on the table, like trying to like make the game, like make and develop and release a whole ass game. Which kind of brings me on to like the next topic, which is it's recently come to light to the surprise of not any other indie developers like on the. Like working like on this platform, but basically indie developer recently kind of like went to Twitter to kind of air his frustrations about the relationships with like PlayStation and the store. So for example, like the complete lack of control over like discounts over the games, the complete lack of communication, and like the exorbitant funds on getting your like games sponsored and like featured, and it's just it's a shame.
I mean it is a bit disappointing after there was the like the big wave a few years back of eventually like all three of the major platform holders got in on that whole sort of like we're friendly to indies. I think in some respects, Nintendo are almost like too friendly to indies now, because there's all sorts of stuff on their store that is not the highest quality, I will say. It's not up to Nintendo's usual high standards, shall we say.
There's already like a few people, like for example Mike Rose he's spoken about how you have to basically like be discoverable during like a Nintendo sale. You have to compete with all the other like games that print themselves out for 1p, you have to discount your game to an absurd degree for people to even see it. And like when it gets to that point, it's kind of the same problem that the Wii had back in the day, where it was just a lot. I'll say it, shovelware. Like there's just a lot of like shovelware where stuff that just hasn't had the same like level of quality assurance.
That's more of an issue with it makes me think of Steam, basically.
Yes,
Steam. Yeah. Since Steam opened their submissions, it opened the floodgates for an awful lot of pretty poor quality releases. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of difficult to pick the good stuff from the bad stuff at times. I know you can develop an eye for it. Sometimes you can spot stuff that is like blatantly, obviously shovelware, because it's got a very clickbaity title, and sort of like you can just tell from the screenshots that it's basically
an asset flip,
or at the very least, it's just a very uninspired concept that just happens to have kind of like you know, partially clothed anime characters tacked onto it or something like that.
They basically got a checklist of all the things that sell, and they're like, how do I fit this into one title?
Yeah, it's sort of like, okay, this game is all about sort of like zombies and sex and what else is popular right now? I don't know, Space Marines. All in one game. Yeah, there's a lot of questionable content on Steam, and I feel like the Switch store is a little bit going that way, but it's not even as easy to browse as Steam is. So I think that is the real problem, is that it's not a huge problem there being an enormous amount of content on there, because it does lower the barriers to allow indie games that wouldn't otherwise be able to release to get out. So to pick an example, something like Bennett Foddy's Getting Over It is such a simple concept, so weird and quirky, and it's not the sort of thing that you would expect any of the major platform holders to have approved as kind of like, yeah, this is something that people will want to play on our platform. But I'm really glad that it exists, because it's so quirky. And that is the sort of thing that I want to see, is games that do something a bit different, and introduce like maybe like new mechanics or new design patterns for games into the industry. And then we can see then maybe like those design patterns getting picked up by, say, Arkane in Deathloop, and iterated on and polished at a AAA level, and so on. Because, frankly, AAA developers are very limited on how experimental they can be, because they're spending a vast amount of money to polish something like Death Stranding and so on. I mean, I have to say, Death Stranding's a bad example, because that is probably the most experimental AAA you can possibly imagine. But mixed results, because a lot of people really don't get on with all of the walking. I quite like the walking. I got frustrated when it forced me into combat, and I found the combat very sort of like clunky and confusing, but I quite enjoyed the process of actually trying to sort of like hike and plan a route and stuff like that. So, you know, there are some AAA developers being experimental. I think that Kojima can afford to be a bit experimental, because people will buy stuff based on the strength of his name.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, that's definitely what happened with Death Stranding to some degree.
But there's not very many studios who can get away with that. Because, you know, people will not buy a new Ubisoft IP just because it's Ubisoft, necessarily. And I think that is... it's an interesting one. The whole sort of, like, auteur concept is it's dodgy enough in cinema, where there are a lot of people working to make a film come together, but still ultimately the director can kind of like shape the look and feel of the film to a much greater extent than they can in games. Because there's just so much more going on in games, so many more moving parts, and so much more to consider. It's not just the kind of like this sounds like I'm being sort of like snooty about film, but I think that this is why sort of like films are better for telling stories, linear stories. They've honed that craft really, really well, and we try to copy them a little bit, and we can do that in places, but we don't do it as well, because we're also trying to juggle game balance and interactivity and sort of like exploration and so on, and
yeah,
and also like, making it run at sort of 60 frames a second.
I guess like that's the thing, like because games are like what you lose for narrative like ability to communicate mm-hmm. the story, you make back in immersion basically, because you embody the characters in the story to a certain degree, and it's just like that's kind of like it's kind of a trade-off. It's not going to be the same thing as a film by any standard.
No.
But yeah, I mean, you could say, oh, technically books are the best medium to convey a story versus a film, because it depending on who you are.
Debatable.
It is absolutely debatable. Yeah.
It is. I mean, every medium has its strengths and weaknesses. Books are really, really good for conjuring a mood and an atmosphere and really digging into a character's thoughts and so on. Film is not so good at getting inside a character's head, but it's very good at, by virtue of sort of like the ability to use music and motion and color and an actor's performance, because our brains are hardwired to sort of like engage with other human beings. So when you see somebody suffering on screen, you are engaged with them. And that at a much more visceral level than maybe with a book, which requires the reader to do a bit more work building up their image of a character in their head. So, you know, like, books are good at some things. Cinema is good at other things. Cinema is a lot more accessible than books, you could argue, because you can just sit back and let it wash over you. But then like games, again, going the other way, require a bit more investment from the player. And then you've got, there's a whole range from your Uncharted style, basically kind of like a linear story that you play through. And that interactivity just makes the player, the audience, more engaged in the story, because they are having to like mash the buttons to get the main character through these trials and tribulations. And that creates engagement, coupled with sort of like great performances and motion capture and facial capture that we're starting to see now in games, that all helps and so on. But also with sort of like the depth of having, for example, the Elder Scrolls, with all of the like the books containing sort of like the history of the world and so on. I love reading books in the Elder Scrolls games and digging into the lore, because the world building is great.
Absolutely. It's one of the best strongest aspects.
In many ways, the kind of like the world, the lore and the history of the world they've created is a bit more interesting than the quests that they actually have you performing in the game.
Yeah.
In some respects. There are things that, so there's Uncharted style sort of like linear movie games, and then you've got stuff that's a bit more flexible, like Mass Effect, where you get to decide the fates of entire planets and species, and you can choose who, you know, based on the interactions that you've had, who you are going to support in a particular conflict and so on. You can make choices that affect the that affect the outcome of that big story. And that was why there was such a backlash at the end of Mass Effect 3, because people felt that the ending undercut all of the choices that they'd made in the past. They felt that it was a game where they could pick a particular character or species to back, and they wanted those changes to be respected, and then sort of like to get to the end of the game and be forced to make a choice that more or less erased all of your own decisions up to that point. I think that speaks to how invested people were in those choices. And like the first three games had done a great job of making people feel like their choices mattered. And then a slight misstep at the end made people feel like their choices didn't matter, created this outpouring of frustration, because that was not what people wanted, I think, from that. But it just goes to show that every medium has its strengths and weaknesses.
True. Yeah, well, I guess at the end of the day, like I just want to see platforms kind of support like indie devs more, and like rather than just like putting up more roadblocks, like kind of get finding the happy medium, because I feel like every so often it ebbs and flows, but like sometimes I feel like it's a bit excessive.
It is, yeah. It's a tricky one, and I think that they each platform holder has come at it from a slightly different perspective. I think probably Microsoft's attitude to indies on Xbox is probably the best balanced at the moment, where you can sign up, you can get dev kits for free, but they kind of, it's not a complete free for all.
There's some moderation to
it. Yeah, there's a bit of moderation to it, and they don't allow any old thing on their platform. I mean, they did when they had the XNA store, that was a little subset of store. A lot of people made some cracking games for XNA, which have subsequently been remastered as sort of like full-on console games and cross-platform games. But there was an awful lot of shovelware on XNA, as people were basically asset flipping demo projects or just experimenting. But then that was kind of the point of it, was to sort of like create a kind of a space where people could just sort of make anything they wanted and experiment and so on. So that was quite a nice opportunity for a lot of up and coming developers to get their feet wet and see what it was like. Nintendo dev kits are cheap, little bit of a black art trying to get on their platform. I struggled a little bit even after 20 years in the industry. I got initially rejected and had to sort of pull some strings with the contact that I'd met at Gamescom, who had advised me to email this, and they got me accepted. So that was cool. But it's a bit of a mystery what the criteria are, because there's a developer just released a calculator app for the Switch, for example.
Yeah.
Which, okay.
Yeah.
I imagine there's some circumstances in which it might be useful if all you had was your Switch and you
didn't on the desert island.
Yeah, didn't have a phone or something. But I think that just speaks to sort of like Nintendo's willingness to just sort of like they do some sort of like checking on who comes on. But there's an awful lot of stuff that despite Nintendo's best efforts is not actually that great released on their platform, and it makes me wonder how it got through lot check, some of it, unless of course like that they have cut back their lot check requirements to be specifically sort of like functional. Does this actually cause any damage to the player's data or the hardware? And as long as it doesn't break anything, they don't care about the quality particularly.
Yeah, that's probably kind of like the route that they've gone down. But yeah, it'd be good to see something like a more, like kind of a separation within the Nintendo store, because like for example, I really, really like what they're doing with the whole like Nindies approach, where they have like a showcase dedicated to indie games and everything. It's really good to see. But yeah, like their store could do with a lot of work.
It would be really nice to see some better discoverability features, because I have been on the Nintendo store looking for game. For example, I really enjoy playing Into the Breach on my Switch. And I was looking for similar games to Into the Breach that would be sort of like nice, sort of like turn-based things that I could sort of play for a bit. But, you know, it didn't matter if I needed to look up to check what stop, you know, what station I was pulling into. It's very hard to navigate the Switch store. Steam is pretty good for finding similar stuff. There's a lot of kind of like links to similar games and so on. Mm-hmm. It is a challenge. It needs a certain amount of work from the platform holder to make sure that they are looking at usage patterns and like identifying commonalities and go sort of like, okay, yeah, like you enjoy Into the Breach, you might enjoy these games that other people who've played Into the Breach have consistently played. And also they share some keywords, and also maybe they're at a similar price point, that sort of thing. But that is quite a lot of work, and it could be that like Nintendo are finding that they are doing just fine with promoting stuff through their Nintendo Direct broadcasts, and then people will go and look for those specific games when they... when they're ready to buy them, they will actually actively search for them, because the awareness of the game is there.
Yeah, absolutely.
In which case, maybe Nintendo are not particularly bothered about whether people can find unknown games on the store. Mm. You'd think they would, though, because people can find stuff that they want, they're more likely to buy.
Absolutely. I think it's something that... they just need to figure out on their own, because they're not listening to anyone else telling them. But I think that's it. That's all we have time for today. But honestly, Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you, as always.
It's always great talking shop. Thanks very much for having me.
No, thank you for joining. And thank you for listening, the dear viewer. If you want to check out more GDL stuff, go to gamedev.london, where you can find our links to socials and Spotify and whatnot, and for more episodes of the podcast. But for now, it's me, this is Chris, and thank you for watching.
Thanks. Bye.